Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Check out our huge in-stock selection of TruBolt door locks. We have a variety of styles and finishes to suit your needs. TruBolt door locks provide homeowners and builders with quality door locks at an affordable price. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. Once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists design a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. The case that I'm going to be talking about today is that of Katie Beers. And whenever I talk about victims, I always have this hope that when I look at their family history, they'll have a supportive framework, because you want victims to have been loved. Even victims who don't get to go home because they get murdered, you want to know that their lives were good lives and that they will be missed. That's the legacy of that loss. You don't want.
There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. Once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists design a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.
They'll look at their lives and think, wow, this girl had huge, huge things stacked against her. But that's exactly what I'm going to talk about right now. When it comes down to Katie Beers' life, the deck was absolutely stacked against her. So Catherine Marie Beers, or Katie as she was better known, really did have a very challenging life early on. She really did. She was born on the 30th of December 1982. Her father was not on the scene. He just wasn't involved. And her mother, Marilyn Beers, well, she didn't actually know who Katie's father was. That would be very difficult for Katie. Obviously, there are lots of people who are single parents, but for children to know where they come from is of primary concern to them. So to literally not have a clue who your dad is means that there's no hope of reconciling with them or forming or forging any kind of relationship, and psychologically that is tough. Marilyn was a hard worker. You know, there's nothing that we can say about that. She was genuinely somebody who was dedicated to earning money. She had two jobs, but work was probably more her cup of tea when it comes down to the kind of thing that she should have spent her time doing. Because as a parent, she was a complete chocolate teapot, I would say. Highly neglectful. I know, chocolate teapot, very psychological term. Very appropriate term. Try putting any kind of boiling water in a chocolate teapot and you'll get the result. Not very effective or efficient, just like Katie's mum. When Katie was 2 months of age, she actually left her with her godmother. So she left her with, as far as she was concerned, a trusted party to babysit her for a few hours because she felt tired. She didn't collect her for weeks. Now, like, we've all done it with people that are looking after our kids, haven't we? You know, maybe got an extra 15 minutes, but you know, a few weeks seems to be a little bit excessive and definitely indicates neglect, abandonment, and let's say a low amount of care for that child. So that babysitting that lasted weeks turned into a more permanent arrangement. From the age of 2, Katie was basically left in the full-time care of her godmother and her godmother's husband in their utterly filthy home in Bayshore. And it was not a place that children would ideally wish to grow up. Now, when her mother has been questioned on this, you'll be unsurprised to know that she says that simply the godparents just refused to give her back. But her godparents said, well, no, her mother didn't want her back. Either way, none of that's good enough. For example, this is how it goes. You have my baby, give me my baby back. No. Right, I'm calling the police to get my baby back. Police arrive, baby given back. Problem solved. There you go. Didn't even have to charge you for that. That's the way it works. So I'm not buying into the fact that they wouldn't give her back. And even though I have literally nothing good to say about her godparents, I will acknowledge that I probably come down on the side of believing them, that Katie's mum just really could not be bothered with the relationship with her daughter. Now, in reality, Katie should have been placed into a foster home because they would have been able to meet the needs of a young child and provide her with a sense of safety. Simple as that. And if she had been placed with a foster family, her whole childhood would have escaped the absolute nightmare that it became. And it really was a nightmare, believe me. So, from age 2, Katie's living with her godmother. This is a woman called Linda Ingillery and her husband, who's a taxi driver, Salvatore Ingillery, or Sal, as he was better known, and certainly is preferable for me to pronounce all the way through here. So these two individuals are meant to offer her a safe space. But as soon as a life with the Ingillerys begin, she is instantly subjected to physical, verbal, and emotional abuse. Bear in mind, she's pretty much been there since she was born, on and off, and at 2 years old, she's living there full time, and immediately she's been subjected to physical, verbal, and emotional abuse. This is a toddler. Wrapping your head around that reality that adults per se, forget adults who are meant to be in charge of the care of a child, adults per se can be anything other than kind to a toddler is mind-blowing to me, let alone physically, verbally, and emotionally abusive. And I want you to think about that from the child's perspective. When you are very, very young, you are obviously taking in your surroundings and you expect and hope from those surroundings a safe experience. If it isn't a safe experience, then your whole understanding of what relationships stand for becomes skewed. And that's really problematic. What we experience early on in our lives, it sets the blueprint out for expectation. And if the blueprint of expectation is potentially full of abuse, then that can really toxify relationships in the future. So when these primary caregivers are ruining a little girl or little boy's childhood, they're also potentially going to impact on every relationship they have from that day on. So it's a major burden for a child who's brought up in these circumstances. But bear in mind, on top of this, this is a child who doesn't even belong to these individuals. She actually is blood related to somebody completely different. She's kind of been handed over. What kind of message does that give to a child? That you were literally so dispensable that your mother just left you for weeks alone with basic strangers to you and then just gave you to them. That is a terrible message for a child to get. Now, obviously, the abuse begins straight away, as I've said, and Sal in particular was a very violent man. I'm going to be judgmental. He was ugly inside and he was ugly outside. Some people just seem to wear the way that they are as a human being on their face. And he's one of those people. He was physically abusive to Katie, also to her half-brother, and in fact to his own wife. So this was a man who domestically abused everyone that he could get his hands on. On one occasion, he actually killed Katie's cat, and he did this by smashing that poor cat's head against the wall whilst she was made to watch. That power play is very challenging for a child to see, because it's giving them a very clear message, which is firstly that the adult has a great deal more power and dominion, and secondly that anything that you love can be taken away from you in an instant. And that's Sal letting her know, I have dominion over you, don't act out. Don't do anything that I say you shouldn't do. Do everything I say you should do. And again, that's forming some very, very unfortunate lessons for the child, because they're starting to believe that they have to do whatever they're told to do. And bear that in mind, because this is how abusers work. They make the victim feel powerless and helpless. And both he and his wife treated Katie like a slave. And they would make her do so many different things. She had to do errands literally from morning until night. They had her going out to buy cigarettes, to buy junk food for them. There's an example where she once brought home the wrong pizza and Linda literally grabbed her by the hair and repeatedly punched her full force in the back for bringing home the wrong pizza. And again, what does that tell you about priorities? That she manages to bring home the wrong thing that they want to eat, but that then lends itself to being physically abused. So Katie's learning early on that her needs are irrelevant and her caregiver's needs are all that matter. And actually on a priority list, she's not even as important as takeaway food. She also had to do all the laundry. Bear in mind, this is a kid who's single figures in age. So from the moment she's walking, she's cleaning. She's doing their vacuuming, she's dusting, she's scrubbing floors, she's doing as much housework as she's asked to do. And this grew even worse after Linda had her left leg amputated due to diabetes. So at this point, Katie's actually made to sleep on the couch. She's very badly neglected. And it's noted by a lot of people who see her on a regular basis, particularly at school. She often attended school unwashed. She would be wearing inappropriate clothing for that time of year. So when she was in the winter, she wouldn't be clothed warmly. The very fact that she wasn't even being given the right kind of attire to cope with the seasons demonstrates the level of abuse. And bear in mind, these are not people who are struggling for money. They're quite happy to feed themselves lots of takeaway food at every hour that God sent. But when it comes down to buying a cardigan, a jumper, or a coat for Katie, that just did not happen. And she was given no money for food either. So she would attend school, but she wouldn't be able to eat there. Another thing that people noticed about her, and again, I don't know why people didn't speak to social services about this, because if you see a child with literally yellow, rotten teeth, then that screams abuse. It really does. And she was seen to have yellow and rotten teeth. Also, she would be spotted around her neighborhood, literally wandering around at all hours. And they did a really horrible thing to her at one point during her childhood. And a lot of you will probably remember the old days. So when my grandma was growing up, and even when my mum was growing up, there used to be a thing where if a child got nips, particularly if that child came from a poorer environment where it wasn't that possible to get lotions and potions, they would literally shave all the hair off. And that's what they did. She had waist long hair and they shaved it off. Now imagine what that's like for a little girl. I mean, there's very few things that make our identity in life, you know, as individuals. It's hard to be that different from the person next to you, but our hair, particularly as a female, the reason it's been revered throughout the ages as far as female hair, the reason that some cultures don't even allow you to see women's hair is because it's meant to be like the most attractive quality, that men can't even control themselves if they see the hair that way and it must be covered. I think they should have all seen my perm. I'm sure they would have just been falling at my feet constantly, particularly when matched with really, really big shoulder pads, even though I was a very, very good swimmer and have shoulders that are substantially bigger than most women. Nevertheless, I digress. I digress a little bit there. But cutting off all her hair, shaving it off, right down to the roots, you know, that would have been very distressing for her. And because of the situation with her home life, her rotten teeth, the way she smelled, the way she looked, people didn't want to be friends with her. She had literally no friends whatsoever. And the local kids actually called her Dirty Katie and cockroach kid. I know, it's awful. When we think back to some of the things that we'll have seen peers do to our other friends, other peers in their classes, it can be pretty overwhelming to look back at some of the things that people got away with. I can remember somebody being called Mrs. Onion because she used to wet her pants regularly. And I remember another one, Mr. Onion, because he cried when he came to school. Now, I didn't involve myself in that. I've actually always stayed away from ever being like that in certain instances where you were around other peers, because I always think to myself, if that person's going to slag that person off to them, they're going to do it about me behind my back. I've always been very aware of that. But a lot of kids do it to fit in, don't they? And if everybody's calling a kid Dirty Katie, well, they'll join in with it. But imagine that isolation, how lonely Katie would have felt. The fact that people are calling her names when she's done nothing wrong. And on top of that, she's going home to this horrific place where, with respect, those primary caregivers who are meant to care for her don't. And one of the things that they do to her one day, these whatever, we can't even call them parents, can we? These individuals who somehow found themselves in the possession of this innocent child, they actually lock her in a pantry when she went to the movies. So for those of you who may not know what the pantry is, it is a place where you kind of have a room where you put lots of food. Sometimes it can be a chilled room, sometimes it can just be a room, like at my grandma's when I was a kid. That's what she had, a pantry. And so they lock her in when they go to the movies, which is, again, horrifically abusive. When they get back, understandably, this is a young child, she has happened to wet herself. Now, you'd imagine that they would then clean her up, acknowledge, hopefully, that what they had done was incorrect, and thus demonstrated by the fact that she soiled herself, so to speak, but no. Instead, Linda just beats her up. Also, she at one point stubbed a cigarette out on her arm. And that is unbelievably abusive, isn't it? Because that's torture. Both of those examples are torture. But when you put cigarette burns in someone's skin, the calculation level of that is incredible, isn't it? You know how hot they are. You know what it's going to do. And you know that it's going to cause an inordinate amount of pain and a mark. So it's all these things. Because to stub something out, you have to really put force onto it. And they're doing this to a little girl. So one of the problems that she also experienced as a child, as well as obviously all this horrendous abuse that occurred, is that she all the way through just wanted to be with her mum. She used to look at her friendships, she used to look at their parents and the way that they were treated by their parents, and she just wanted that for herself. She longed for those relationships. And there she is with these horrible nightmare human beings who were just enjoying abusing her. But I do think that maybe that relationship that she was craving, it was fantasy-based. I don't think her mother was capable of loving Katie in the way that she deserved. Why would she have given away so easily? Why wouldn't she have fought for her? But I understand that for Katie, it would have been the idea of, if only I was with my mother, things would be better, things would be easier. You would think that what I've just described to you could not get any worse, but it does. Because Sal wasn't just a physical abuser and an emotional abuser and neglectful, no. He was also a sexual sadist, so to speak, and he was a child molester. So he begins to sexually abuse the toddler, literally when she was two. When she moved in, and as far as he was concerned, he had control over her, that was when he made his move. And at the point where he started to abuse her, she wasn't even able to complete sentences. That's how young she was. Now, he would wait till everybody had gone to bed, and then he would molest her. And it was a very regular basis. Initially, he would touch her whilst he was masturbating. But then as she grew older, the frequency of the abuse increased and he would make her engage with him in sexual acts. And then eventually, even when she was still very young, I'm talking single figures, he also began raping her. And she recalls this. So I'm going to share it with you because this is what she went through, this is what she endured, and this is the kind of person that Sal was to this poor, innocent child. He was very, very overweight. He was morbidly obese, and that meant that obviously he was restricted, so he would make her go on top of him. And she was so disturbed by this, even though she didn't understand what was happening, she was disturbed by it. So she would go and hide and he would hunt her down. There was literally no escape. Initially, like with most abuse cases that are sexually orientated, she was too young. She didn't have a clue what the abuse was like. She didn't like it. She didn't want it to happen. It made her feel deeply uncomfortable. But because it was so consistent and because no one was telling her, hey, this isn't normal, you need the help that you deserve to get you out of this situation, it kind of got normalized for her. And he was even known to abuse her while she slept. She also, at this point, only had one friend, just one. And Katie recalled that Sal purposefully and willfully scared that friend of hers away. What he did was he ordered Katie to bring her to his bedroom window. And when this little girl was looking through, he took his clothes off, got completely naked, and then asked this friend if she wanted to play with him. Now, you won't be surprised to know that well-adjusted child who came from a loving background ran away screaming. I mean, with respect, seeing Sal naked may have done that anyway, per se, but certainly, can you imagine what that would be like for that little girl? She's with a friend. Her friend's been forced to bring her to the window. She's been violated just by the fact that she's actually had to see this individual do that. And he's tried to get this friend involved in the abuse. Again, suggests that obviously for Katie, that feels like he was making her get to a position where the friend would abandon her. But I think we can all agree he would have been wanting her to bring other people that he could abuse. And he was probably hoping he'd get away with it. Now, Sal was really angry with Katie that her friend hadn't pleasured him, so to speak, so that he raped Katie. So that was her punishment, basically, for not getting him extra children that he could abuse. Now, when that friend went home to her parents, she told them what had happened. And understandably, that meant that that friend was never allowed to play with Katie again, which must have been agony, because she literally was the most isolated, lone child. And in that moment where she had a friend and she could kind of hang out with them, she had that taken away from her just because her apparent whatever father, foster father, kidnapper, I don't know what you call him, honestly, man who lived at a house where a child should never have been allowed to go. I literally don't know how to respond or refer to Sal because they weren't anything godparent. He wasn't even one of them. It was his wife who was a godparent. He's just some random man who somehow has access to this lovely child. Now, understandably, that girl, her parents called Child Protective Services and they then called to ask questions. But Katie was absolutely terrified. She didn't know what to say. She didn't know what would happen if she told the truth. So she did the easiest thing that was catastrophic for her, but makes complete sense to all of us. She lied and said that her friend had made it all up. And clearly, because that wasn't corroborated, they let that case drop. Linda Illigary, her godparent, now she would sometimes work on sex chat lines, just giving you an overview of what this child went through in their childhood. So while she was once on the phone to a customer having a phone sex chat, and no disrespect, this is something that always kind of makes me kind of giggle a little bit because people who use phone sex lines don't see the person, do they? It's all fantasy based. But I do wonder if they could see pictures of who they were talking to, whether they would get as sexually stimulated as they do. I don't know. Just saying. Might just be me. Is it just me? It might just be me. But I think it is all of you as well. Just to see that reality, if they could actually acknowledge what was going on when they were talking to that person, whether the person was what they imagined in their head. I believe 9 out of 10 times it would not be. But during one of her phone sessions with a customer, she actually tells him that she has a little girl lying next to her. And then she makes Katie speak to the man. During this conversation that would obviously have been highly inappropriate per se, because it's a child, that is an absolute violation to have a child anywhere near a sex line. But the conversation got to a point where Katie actually starts crying. So I dread to think the kind of content, shall we say, that was being discussed. But those boundaries that are failed in every way, shape or form in that moment, the fact that this woman, Linda, an apparent godparent thinks it's acceptable to have that child anywhere near sex lines is horrifying. And when Katie starts crying, as you would do when you were a kid, it's really traumatizing going through that. She slaps her across the face for her trouble, simple as that. Both Linda and Sal were also complete sexual deviants. So Linda is not in any way, shape or form innocent in this. And that is no worse than Sal, even though we find it shocking that women get involved in exploiting children. They do. But Linda and Sal make her watch pornographic material. So Sal would actually make her masturbate him whilst he watched pornography, and Linda would actually pleasure herself whilst making Katie watch porn with her. Honestly, some people just don't deserve to have anything good ever happen to them. Just when I was saying that then, it's like the filth that comes to mind regarding the minds of those people. The fact that this little girl is being witness to this awful stuff that she'll have had no idea about, and she shouldn't have had any idea about because she was a kid, and these adults are just using her for sexual stimulation. It's horrifying. The Child Protective Services did actually visit her on more than one occasion, but it was really difficult for her because she's a kid. I mean, one, knowing how to relay the abuse that's happening, you have to understand that it's wrong. Secondly, you have to trust that you can look to adults to support you. How would she have been able to do either of those things? She had literally been handed away like old goods when it came down to her birth mother giving her to the godparent, etc. Then she'd been treated so badly by these adults who were meant to protect her. Why would she trust that these strangers who came to ask her questions were going to do anything different? How would she have ever really conceptualized that there was a life that was better, that was possible for her? And like we always say, for a lot of people who are abused, the truth is they don't even realize that it's happening. They just think it's normal. So the other thing that they made a mistake of when they actually came to talk to her about the potential of her being abused is they were talking to her in the very room where the abuse actually took place. So all of those factors would have colluded to have made it almost impossible for Katie to have actually told social services what was happening to her. I think at this point, we're all probably amazed that this child is surviving per se in such horrific conditions. But I'm going to make it even worse for you, because just 3 days before her 10th birthday, life was going to take an even more sinister turn, literally. So as I've detailed, Katie had the most horrific life at home. And because of this, she'd started to gravitate towards the home of a family friend and neighbour. He was called John Esposito. He was a 43-year-old contractor carpenter. Now, he was known to the family and to local people as Big John. And that's because he was like a very big child, shall we say, apparently. Well, his home at least reflected this idea, so he would let local kids come and play games in his garage, which he'd converted himself into an apartment, and he'd give them lollies. It became a really favourite hangout for local kids after school. And Katie described his home as a toy store, a candy store, and an amusement park all in one. So I think that we can all get a gauge of just why this place was so popular and why children just congregated there. They had a walk-in wardrobe in his bedroom, and that walk-in wardrobe was literally stacked with board games and video games that any of the kids that could imagine, they were there. So it was a perfect place for children to just get to do all the things that they like to do and also have access to things that maybe they couldn't afford. He even had a mini fridge and it was filled with fizzy drinks. However, there was only one television in his home where kids could actually play these computer games. Shall we have a guess? Shall we have a guess where it was? That's right. It was in the lounge in a communal area where everyone could sit down and play. No, it wasn't. It was in his bedroom. Of course, it was in his bedroom. And why do you think it was in his bedroom? Because Esposito basically acted like this great big brother and a mentor to all the kids. And in fact, Katie's older half-brother, John, he also considered him a really big friend. He was somebody who gave him access to things that he loved doing, and he could go and play, and he became known as Little John. Now, he was 6 years older than Katie, and the reason that he would go there is because his mother felt that he needed a male role model in his life. Because of that, Katie would actually sometimes join them on things like going out on trips. And she liked Big John. And one of the reasons was that he would give her presents. That in itself, as we would imagine, when you get nothing from the place where you live regarding your caregivers giving you nice presents and so on and so forth, when another human being offers you that kind of solace and makes you feel that you matter and does nice things for you, of course, you're going to want to go to them, because who wouldn't? It's got to be better than the place you get horribly abused. However, I'm sure a few of you wanted this already, there was a reason why Esposito's home was like a child's dream. That's right, because he was actually a paedophile and a sexual predator. So he had designed his home to accommodate what every child dreams of, because he wanted to accommodate children, so he had access to those children. Can you get more predatory than that? Literally designing your home so that children would feel safe there, and so that you could gradually coerce them into being what you consider the perfect victim. And that's what he did. And we know that he was a sexual predator, because 15 years previously, he'd actually grabbed a 12-year-old boy in a shopping center where he'd attempted to abduct him. Horrifying. Now, Katie and her half-brother's visits to that house, well, they ended very suddenly, because someone actually told their mother that he'd touched her son in a bad way. So little John would later actually confirm that he was sexually abused by Esposito for years. However, in spite of the fact that he'd been abused, he never reported him. And the reason for that was he still considered him a friend. If there was ever anything that describes why abuse is so confusing, it's that sentence, isn't it? That little John, who was horribly molested by this paedophile, believed that he was a friend. And even though he did all these horrible things to him, because he had this connection and he believed that there was love between them, albeit that he'd been exploited by that, he didn't want to cause him any problems. So he didn't report him. That's what happens in so many abuse situations. Imagine that. The child feels that they have to protect the abuser. That's what makes sexual abuse so damn difficult for people who've experienced it, because there are all of these different feelings that they experience. And it's why we really have to understand the abuse cycle, how powerful it is, how it traps children and young people and young adults and adults all the way through their lives at times, believing that somehow, because they had loving feelings for the person who did it to them, that they must have been on side with that person, they must have wanted it, and all these things that are mismatches and not real whatsoever. But that's what happened. Esposito never got brought to justice for the crimes against little John, because little John struggled to navigate what he felt for his friend versus what his friend had done to him. So by the time this played out with Katie's half-brother and Big John, Katie was 9 years of age, and she was living part of the time with her godmother and the rest of the time with her biological mother. Apparently at this point, the two women were in a feud over her custody. And the reason for that is because Sal's abuse had started coming to light. He was actually facing first-degree sexual abuse charges after Marilyn had reported him to the police. So this is really positive. Obviously, we now have Katie in a situation where the abuse is hopefully being taken seriously. He'd been arrested 2 months earlier and basically was due to appear in court in the February. Meanwhile, a court order actually had been put in place because Katie needed to be protected, and that meant that Sal wasn't allowed to be near her at all. So this court order forbade him from coming into contact with Katie. However, a visit had been arranged to her auntie Linda's. I don't know why. I'll tell you why I struggle with this. If I thought that my child had been molested by Linda's partner, present or past, and Linda had any possibility of having anything to do with Sal anymore, I would not have allowed my child within a million miles. And to be fair, if I had found out that Linda had been present when Sal had been having access to my child, I again would have thought, you know what, don't really want her around Linda anymore. Linda doesn't seem like a sure little thing.
There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. Once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists assign a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long-term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.
Probably somebody that I should avoid, but nevertheless, for some reason, that's all irrelevant, and there is this trip that's been arranged for her to go to Auntie Linda's. Auntie Linda's. Delightful Auntie Linda. Abusive, sexual deviant Auntie Linda. What a dream of a trip. So she planned a birthday party for her, and basically she'd be staying there for a few days before her birthday. Sal, at this point, was apparently no longer living there. Linda had taken out a restraining order against him, and Katie was under strict instructions from her mother to contact the police if he, as in Sal, or Esposito showed up at all. Shouldn't have trusted Linda. Why would anybody trust Linda? Linda, who gets children involved in sex lines. Unfortunately, in spite of the fact that Linda's meant to have this restraining order against Sal, it seemed that it wasn't really very effective because he was still on the scene. Also, Katie's godmother didn't have the same reservations about Esposito. Yeah, convicted child molester and Katie's half-brother's child molester. But Linda's like, oh, you know, he's a really nice guy. What kind of harm can this guy kind of do? I don't know. Massively abused children, potentially, like paedophile child molesters do. Anyway, Marilyn, who was very concerned, had warned Katie about not going anywhere near these two. But you've got to understand, Katie didn't have a lot of power in this situation, particularly if Linda isn't concerned. And Linda believed he was a nice man. And so she continued to let him be around Katie. And in the lead up to Katie's 10th birthday, by this point, think about all the things I've told you about her life. By this point, she's not even 10. She's been raped repeatedly, molested horribly, treated disgustingly, abused, used as a slave, and she's not even 10 years of age. Also, Esposito had been making more and more attempts during these days leading up to her 10th birthday to get her on her own. So whenever Linda was napping, he'd show up, we'd try to lure her away with a promise of sweets and toys. But because Katie had been told clearly by her mother that she was forbidden from being anywhere around him, in light of the allegations concerning a half-brother. However, like I said, Linda made it possible. So he gets this opportunity, it's literally a few days before her 10th birthday, it's the 28th of December, 1992. And Linda tells Katie that Esposito is going to take her out for a treat. It's an early birthday present. Oh, I get really angry when I think about things like this. Just the way that child molesters can manipulate people, because that's what's playing out. Don't get me wrong, I don't think Linda's very difficult to manipulate because she doesn't really care, does she, about Katie? So she's quite happy to do whatever other people want. It'll just be to please him, and she's not really that concerned about the relationship she has with Katie or Katie's safety. So Esposito is apparently going to take her out for a treat. It's going to be an early birthday present. Katie, who is a very young child but is very savvy and wise by this point, she expresses a concern. Her mum said no. She's forbidden it. and she doesn't want to go, but Linda is insistent. Simple as that. She says that they're not going to tell her mum that she's gone and that he's going to get her loads of nice things, so it's going to be worth them going. So ultimately, Katie does what she's told. Of course she does. Why? Because we all know what happens to Katie if she dares to step outside of doing exactly what Linda tells her. She gets beaten. She knows the consequences of incurring Linda's wrath. She's lived it for many years. So Esposito arrives at the house and he's got a gift. He brought her a Barbie dream house. Now look, can you imagine that? Just put yourself in a position of a horribly abused, neglected, abandoned child. And this guy, he comes around and he's bought you the Barbie dream house. I mean, they were expensive. I'm sure they're expensive now. But for a little girl, that would be like a dream. And then it's really confusing because you want the dream house and you don't want to be nasty to the person who's brought it round. But at the same time, you're scared of the person who's brought it round and you don't know what to do and you've no power. That's what's going on for Katie. He then tells her that he's going to take her to the Spaceplex video arcade. And he doesn't, even though he tells her that. That's just the way of luring her out. Instead, he takes her to Toys R Us and they buy a Nintendo game. Bear in mind, we know where the TV is in his house. We know why the TV is in his bedroom, so that he can take kids there to play the Nintendo game. After they've bought this, he takes her back to his home in Bayshore, New York. As you can imagine, you know exactly what he's intending to play out. They then sit down in his bedroom on his mattress and they're playing Nintendo. Curtains are closed, lights are off, of course they are. He doesn't want to draw any attention or anybody to be aware that he's got this 9-year-old little girl in his bedroom. And even though it sounds sinister enough to even describe that to you right now, this adult, this grown-ass man, sat with this 9-year-old girl, who he's basically procured for reasons that I think we all can understand. Even though Katie suspected that there was something unfolding that she was not going to enjoy in this moment. Even though Katie suspected that she potentially was in a scenario where something bad could happen to her, it had happened to her half-brother, she had no possible inkling of what was actually going to unfold. Because she could never have predicted the utterly sinister plan that this man had in mind with her. She felt very uneasy. She knew that she wasn't supposed to be there. Also, it was the first time that she'd ever been alone with him in his bedroom. And suddenly he came up behind her and he whispered in her ear, "I'm not going to hurt you, Katie." I mean, you can imagine where her brain would go in that moment. You know, it's our normal expectation that people aren't going to hurt us. We don't walk around thinking the whole world's about to kill us or attack us or harm us. Quite the contrary. We're always thinking, well, I'm with this person, they're not going to hurt us. That's what you think. The very fact that he says, "I'm not going to hurt you, Katie," is indicative of the fact that he has something sinister going on, that he has to reassure her nothing bad's going to happen. And she said that suddenly she knew he was not the Big John that she'd got to know. He was someone else. He was someone sinister. She actually knew in that instant straight away that she was in trouble. And he grabbed her. He instantly forced his hand up her skirt. He penetrated her with his finger. And he then picked her up and he carried her screaming downstairs. And while she's screaming and she's hysterical and she's fearing obviously for her life, he says, "I have something I want to show you." At that point, he takes her to his office, which is in his converted garage, and he unscrewed a bookcase from the wall. And in that bookcase was a secret compartment. Now, whilst he was doing this, Katie had actually managed to dial 911 on his office phone, but unfortunately he noticed and he stopped her before she had a chance to speak. And he screamed at her, "Do not touch that phone again." He actually threw her against the wall at this point, and her back hit some exposed nails and she sliced her skin. This is all going on within moments. You know, she must have been so deeply confused. She knows something terrible's happening. She's got this wherewithal to actually ring the police. She's trying to protect herself. She's getting injured. But there's a lot going on in these moments. And to be honest, Katie is very bright because she's trying to figure her way out. So after she's been hurt, he rolls back the carpet and he uncovers this really large 200-pound concrete trap door. He has to winch it up. And when he winches it up, it reveals this vertical shaft. And he actually shouts at her, get down the fucking hole. This is to a 9-year-old child. Days before a 10-year-old birthday. She's a little kid. Get down the fucking hole, he says. She refuses. Again, how brave is that kid? Katie's amazing. Because she knows that this is terrible and that she can't comply. But obviously, he has got far more power and he can overwhelm her and overpower her. And he actually gets her and he drops her down this 7-foot shaft. Then he makes her crawl through a narrow 6-foot long, 2-foot high tunnel to a tiny door. And this led to a box within a box. The outer box was concrete. It was just 6-foot wide by 6-foot high and 7 feet long. How claustrophobic is that? It had been covered in foam and insulation so that it was soundproof. This was prepared. In one corner, there was a toilet. It wasn't connected to anything. It just had a bin bag in the toilet bowl. And in here, raised off the ground, was an inner box. So a box within a box within a box. And it was a small wooden cabinet-sized structure. It wasn't very much bigger than a coffin. It measured just 2 feet wide by 3 feet high and 7 feet long. The walls there were covered in egg cartons for soundproofing, padlocked on the outside. He forced that little girl inside and he padlocked a chain around her neck, which was bolted to the wall. She was absolutely terrified. She was almost hyperventilating and she asked when she could go home. And he said to her, this is your home now, that he'd specially built the concrete bunker to imprison her. I don't even want to think how that child managed being told those words. This is your home now, and I've built this specially for you. The idea that this is where you're going to live out your lives. The idea that no one's going to know where you are, that no one can hear you. Now, obviously, Esposito has a problem. He has a child that he's been seen with last. So he basically needs to cover his tracks. So yet again, even though this is kind of difficult, you know, he's the only one who's been seen with this little girl, as in hours before she was handed over to him. He's meant to be taking her out for all of the day for her birthday treats, etc. The police are going to know that he had access to her, so he's going to be a prime suspect. So he needs to think about a way of dissuading the police that he is the perpetrator. But just like he's planned building this coffin prison, he already has thought about this. So he actually forces Katie to record a message. And this is what she records. Aunt Linda, a man kidnapped me and has a knife. And oh no, here he comes right now. Imagine having to say that. Aunt Linda, a man kidnapped me and has a knife. And oh no, here he comes right now. But that's what she had to do. He made her practice it lots of times before he eventually left her alone to record it. And she did as she was told. Obviously, she wanted to protect herself. However, God, she's bright. So after she's recorded that message, she leaves a long pause at the end. And then she whispers, Big John took me. He has me at his house. Imagine the courage it took to do that. But obviously, when Esposito plays the recording, he keeps it going and he hears what she's done and then he goes and strikes her across the face and he says to her that she'll get hurt if she does it again. And obviously, that would make sense. This is a man who has kidnapped her, molested her half-brother and now has her locked in a basic coffin. And he's hit her on a few occasions by this point. So it makes sense to her that she is genuinely at risk. So once she manages to record the tape correctly, Esposito then drives to Spaceplex. Here he's seen pretending to look for Katie and he actually reports her missing to the manager. And he says, I can't find a little girl. claims that she'd gone to get changed and they'd become separated. He then goes to a payphone. It's near the arcade, and he calls the godmother, Linda, the whatever use she is, and he plays this recording that Kate has made. So Linda's answering machine picks it up and records it. So as he's planned, the police later trace the call to the payphone, and Esposito is obviously hoping he's going to fool the authorities into believing that Kate has been abducted by an unknown third party. The FBI later analysed the message, and they're instantly able to confirm that it was Katie's voice, but they're really suspicious about it because of the way it sounds, because there's no background noise whatsoever. Now, bear in mind where she was meant to be. She was meant to be at a children's arcade. If she'd been kidnapped, even if she was in somebody else's home, you would imagine some kind of background crackling noise, but it's a very pure tape, and it sounds, as far as they're concerned, as if it had been recorded in a soundproofed room. So on one level, the fact that she said that she'd been kidnapped would make sense, because obviously if she was in a soundproof room, she could have been kidnapped and placed there. But why would she have had access in a soundproof room to a phone? And why would she have then got cut off when this person apparently is coming to find her again? You know, oh no, he's coming to get me. Doesn't make sense. If she was in a soundproof room, he'd already got her, and the likelihood is she wouldn't have had access to anything to call anyone. So they are suspicious on all those levels. And again, the big problem you've got is, even though it was like it had been recorded in a soundproofed room, the police couldn't really do any more to find out about it because it had been recorded on an answering machine on Linda's phone, so it was impossible to tell. It was just their suspicions. 20 minutes after making that call, Esposito then calls Katie's godmother, and he's crying on the phone. He's saying he can't find Katie, he's lost Katie. So now he's trying to act like, look, I'm looking for Katie, I'm desperate for her, and obviously expecting Linda to be like, oh my God, I've just heard she's been kidnapped. It's not like the police wouldn't go, oh, Esposito, let's do a bit of a background check on this guy. Turns out he's a child abuser and tried kidnapping a kid. Probably going to be our chief suspect. But no, he hasn't worked that through. He's just trying to create this amazing reasoning as to why it couldn't possibly have been him. But the lengths he's going to is giving us some insight, isn't it? Esposito really is in this at this point for the long term. He wants to make damn sure he gets away with whatever he can for as long as he can, ideally forever. Now, authorities immediately launched a nationwide manhunt. They wanted to find her. There was a huge media campaign. They were doing everything they could to bring Katie home. For Katie, of course, she's unaware of this all playing out. She's in this tiny prison, and she starts having this really terrifying revelation. She realizes, a year and a half previously, she'd been playing with other children in a large hole in the grounds of Esposito's home. So she's sitting there and playing through her brain the fact that, in hindsight, she suddenly realized the dirt that had been excavated was the dirt that had been excavated in the process of building the bunker that she was now imprisoned in. Esposito had been planning Katie's abduction for a hell of a long time, preparing it for a hell of a long time. He had built an impenetrable, undetectable prison designed specifically to keep her confined. All he needed was the opportunity to get his hands on the 9-year-old girl. Imagine that. And all her tiny prison contained, by the way, was a black and white television set and a thin camping mattress. And it was sweltering hot down there. Katie was kept permanently chained to the wall. There were also handcuffs, but because she was so tiny and her wrists were so small, they kept sliding off. She was also kept in pretty much complete darkness, and that's really sensorily depriving. Believe me, when you are kept in darkness, it's like torture. It's not what our senses are used to. Remember, it's soundproof as well. So the very fact that she's being deprived this way would have been psychologically deeply traumatizing and torturing. The only light that came at all was from this small black and white TV screen. She was also forced to endure, you know, the smell of the prison that she was in with the toilet that she used, because the actual toilet itself was outside her prison box. So when she was in the box, she had to use a space at the foot of her mattress instead. And then she used to have to try to use the blanket to try and clean herself. Just imagine what that was like for her, pungent smell of her own feces and urine. She had no natural light. She had no idea of time. And that's how her captivity felt, like one long nightmare, an endless nightmare, with no understanding of what day it was, what time it was, whether it was night or day, totally deprived. The thing I would say, though, is Katie is one damn resilient spirit. So if you're struggling with this, just stay with it, because it really is worth it. Because sometimes you're introduced to these characters who, for the grace of God, have got this resilience within them that they're not even there aware of. And that story is the one that I'm going to be telling you. Now, we know that Linda and Sal were horribly abusive to Katie. And despite this, when the actual thing starts playing out in the media that Katie disappeared, of course, they're there, aren't they? Like flies on shit. Linda and Sal are there appearing in the media, playing the part of their distraught guardians. Her godmother repeatedly played Katie's favourite song to reporters, Disney's A Whole New World. That's actually a really appropriate song. And I imagine that when Katie was playing A Whole New World to herself, she was imagining that that's what she wanted, a whole new world away from these sexual sadists, molesting, lying individuals who had kept her in a hellhole of a life for many years themselves. So, nonetheless, of course, now these godparents or whatever, they are godforsaken human beings, are trying their best to look like they really care. By the way, they're also chain smoking cigarettes at this point. So her sexual abuser, Sal, he's even sat in Katie's room looking sadly at the camera. And then for some reason, he's back on the scene, even though there's a massive restraining order and a court order forbidding him to actually be near Kate. Also, in a bedroom, festooned with Disney bedspreads and toys. That's how they presented it, yeah? Absolute bull. She hadn't even been in that room. She'd usually slept on the couch. So it was just a massive fabrication. All they were trying to do is play for the cameras and seem to be these caring adults. That, to me, spanks absolutely of deep manipulation. You know, the Machiavellian level there of trying to say that you had been these endearing human beings who cared only for this child when you know what you did to her. You know that wherever she is, it's likely it can't be in a worse place than where you placed her for many years. And even though, of course, it's terrible that Katie's been kidnapped in this way, it just frustrates me horrifically that these human beings are now pretending to be nice people who cared for this little girl. Now, when you see Sal Inglery in Katie's bedroom, it's kind of vomit-inducing as far as I'm concerned. It really is. Now, none of us are surprised that Esposito was the prime suspect from the get-go. She's disappeared. He's got this history. And also, he's the last person to be seen with her. Also, the surveillance video placed him at Spaceplex Arcade, which is the scene of the alleged abduction. However, it shows him entering the arcade alone. So, like I said, nothing like a not-so-clever perpetrator for not being able to quite piece together the appropriate story that would be required to get away with this. So the police basically interview him for 18 hours. They really believe they've got the guy. And he tells them this story that he'd taken Katie to a toy shop to buy a birthday present because he's such a great guy. I mean, in my history, I'm a child molester and kidnapper. I'm a great guy. I've really changed, even though I have a lot of kids around and I've got the only TV in my house is in the bedroom with the games that I force kids to come around. And okay, yeah, maybe I've been molesting kids. But you know what I'm saying? This guy genuinely thinks he can pull the wool over the police's eyes. So he says that he's convoluted this story, essentially bought her a present, and then they'd gone to the arcade, and then she'd just disappeared. Now, despite the fact that they're not buying his story, they have a problem, because they have really searched his property well, and they can't see any sign of the little girl. This is really painful on reflection, because of course we know, as they will in the future, that Katie was literally just a few feet away, just below the ground. Now, a second suspect was Sal. Bear in mind the sexual abuse allegations he was facing, which again makes you go, why were the press interviewing this man? Why was anyone giving him any screen time? One could argue they wanted to catch him out. They do that a lot on TV. They kind of interview people to see how they'll act in a certain circumstances, and they just come across as guilty as hell. But obviously he shouldn't have even been in that home. Now, Katie obviously is unaware of all this playing out, but she will have had an inkling as to why Esposito abducted her. And it becomes very, very clear pretty much from the get-go of him having her in that horrible coffin-shaped prison. He asks her whether she's ever had sex before. She tells him what Ingleray has done to her. And he was actually pleased by this. He felt like that made her experienced. So on the very first day of her horrible captivity, he rapes her. And he would visit her daily in prison. He would molest her every single day. She said, Big John came down to my cage regularly. It seemed like once a day he would bring me a toy or juice and then he would rape me. The 9-year-old child had been taken from her invisible prison of her abusive godparents' home to a concrete prison of another sexual predator. But you know what? Like I said, if there's one good thing that had come from that horrific life of abuse, it was this. That little girl, she knew how to survive. She'd been surviving for a very long time. And you know what? It enabled her to keep calm and it enabled her to think clearly. And believe me, none of us want her to have gone through any of this. But in this moment, in this situation, it's her surviving for so long that lets her think about strategy. She'd lived through a nightmare for years, and she knew she could survive this one too. Unbelievably, this is whilst Katie was helplessly shackled in a concrete prison. Police were just feet away. They even had set up a command post on Esposito's lawn. But even though she could scream, they couldn't hear her because she was buried so far below the ground and he'd soundproofed the bunker, which is just unbelievable, isn't it? Now, during her captivity, Esposito would obviously feed her. He fed her a diet of junk food, basically, mostly given fizzy drinks, sweets. This actually included after-eat mints. She's actually always been repulsed by their taste from this point onwards. She refused to eat any of the food he cooked for her because she believed that he had poisoned it. I mean, imagine how savvy she is. She's thinking, I am going to survive this and I'm going to make sure that I protect myself at all costs, even if that means making him bring me food that's packaged so I know that he hasn't interfered with it. He would also play constantly Whitney Houston's version of I Will Always Love You. It had just been released at the time, and he had it on MTV and on VH1. She would literally listen to that regularly. And because of that, she's never been able to listen to it since, because obviously it reminds her of that captivity. Katie actually spent her 10th birthday shackled in her coffin-sized prison, and audio tapes that were bizarrely recorded by Esposito of Katie's confinement would later be recovered. And in one, she can actually be heard singing happy birthday to herself. I mean, how lonely must that kid have been? But also there's a bit of me that's like, go Katie, the fact that you're like, well, if no one else is gonna sing me happy birthday, then damn it, I'm gonna sing it myself. During her imprisonment, Katie was also terrified to fall asleep. She was really fearful that Esposito would molest her if she did while she was asleep. He'd already told her that he planned to photograph her while she was sleeping. So she knew that this was a possibility. And this is while the investigation around his home's intensifying. And what he wanted to do was he wanted to leak an image of her being asleep to the police to make it look like she was already dead. So he hoped that this would cause the detectives to just call off the search for her, or at least tone it down. You're like, Esposito, I'm not sure a picture of a child who may appear dead would mean they didn't think that you were the person who'd killed her. I think they think you're the person who's got her. I don't think that you are going to get away with this right now. It's not looking good. But nonetheless, this is what he's planning. Subsequently, she actually decided that she wouldn't sleep. So it was very rare that during her captivity that she slept at all. She was terrified. She didn't want the police to stop looking for her. She didn't want them to believe that she was dead. And again, what is that telling you about this incredible child? What an unbelievable survivor. Due to Katie's experiences during her life so far, she was so much more streetwise than the average 9-year-old girl. We wish she wasn't, But in this moment, she needs to be. So she starts using this to her advantage. She's amazing psychologically. She really is. She starts playing mind games with him. And at every single opportunity, she starts bombarding him with questions about the future. She asks him, how am I going to go to school? He says, I'll teach you what you need to know. She says, how will she work? He says, oh, I've got enough money. I can take care of the two of us. Katie later said, I definitely think that by trying to manipulate him into thinking about the future and things like that, I think it got him a little bit scared and worried about what the future was going to hold. So Katie basically continually tells the captor that she loves him, she wants him in her life, but only if he lets her go. So she's building this idea that, you know, we have a relationship, I do care for you, I don't want you to get into trouble, I do want to be with you, but I need to be free. This is so clever. She's just 10. She's having conversations that very few of us would even think of, and she's doing it in an adept manner. So he tells her he loves her too. He says that he's taken her in to protect her. Not being funny, putting me in a soundproof coffin isn't really selling this idea, but okay. But you can kind of see that he himself is getting captivated by this child who's starting to give him what he thinks he wants, which is this mutually reciprocal relationship. We all know that's not true, it's warped. But in his mind, this deluded state, she asking him about what they're going to do. And Katie is so good at this that she goes one step further and she actually says to him, how are they going to get married and have kids in the future? And he says, when she turns 18, they'll get married and they'll start a family together. And this is just what a paedophile molester wants to hear. The idea that this is a consensual relationship. This is a 10-year-old child. There's nothing consensual about it. But for him, well, it very much plays into that position that she's built a relationship and that she doesn't mind being here. She's so clever. And he then says to her, I'm going to keep you down here forever until people forget about you. They'll forget. You'll marry me. You'll have children with me. You won't have to go to college because I'll take care of you forever, Katie. You're like, music to Katie's ears? I don't think so. But she's done a really good job of starting to make him think about this long term. Now, worryingly for Katie at times, Esposito actually starts talking about killing himself. Now, she's terrified by this because if he kills himself, well, he won't be able to look after her. And if she's left locked up, that would be the end of her life. But also she thinks, well, what if he decides to kill me too? So that's terrifying for her. Katie's disappearance is massive news, by the way, at this point. It's attracted nationwide attention. There's pressure on authorities, understandably, to find her. So in turn, the investigators start really turning up the heat on their prime suspect. And they start making it clear that they feel that he is the individual holding Katie. And somehow, thankfully, after holding Katie captive for 17 days, it seems that Esposito finally sees sense. And evidently, he realizes he can't get away with kidnapping her and keeping her a prisoner forever. He realizes that it's likely only a matter of time before the police discover her. Thank God. So on the 13th of January 1993, after speaking to his lawyer, Esposito turns himself in. And he admits to detectives that he kidnapped Katie. He then took them to the subterranean dungeon where she's hidden and they were utterly shocked. They had thoroughly searched his property, but the bunker was so well hidden, they literally missed it. Linoleum flooring and carpeting covered the concrete trapdoor and that was hidden in a closet area and the entrance was also obscured by a bookcase. He'd made it really difficult for them to find her. At the point that the police come, Katie's shackled in the bunker. She hears her captor approaching. However, at this point, he's not alone. And when the police officers enter the dungeon, she just believed that they were there to abuse her. She thought she brought other men to sexually assault her. It's only when the uniformed men identify themselves as police that she realizes that she might finally be free. She's then taken out from the underground prison. And ironically, at that point, she was questioned by the police in Esposito's front room, and he's literally sitting nearby. She said at that point, she still wasn't actually convinced that the officers were genuine. She was just really scared that this was some kind of horrible, cruel game and that she was going to get returned to her cell. But when she was finally permitted to leave, she actually hugged Esposito and she told him she loved him. Can you imagine that? The fact that she was so relieved in that moment, she was so completely confused by the fact that this man had actually set her free, that she had really positive feelings towards him. I totally get that. Obviously, she doesn't love him. But the fact that he freed her, the fact that she didn't die, the fact that she hasn't spent years and years there, you know, that liberation just made her want to let him know that she appreciated it. She was absolutely terrified. She finally left that property in a police patrol car, surrounded by a crowd of photographers. And she was free. She was free. After that dramatic rescue, police excavated grounds around Esposito's home and they unearthed his horrific underground prison network. They actually feared that he might have used it before to keep all the victims there before Katie. So they brought in sniffer dogs that know how to sniff out if dead bodies have been there. And they looked for buried bodies, but none were found, thankfully. Thank God, none were found. Now, investigators later stated, FBI experts say they've seen a lot of these hidden rooms, but they have never seen one constructed as meticulously in such an elaborate manner. This guy had put in a huge amount of effort to making that underground bunker. As soon as investigators begin to actually speak to Katie about her ordeal, well, then the truth absolutely rolls out about the horrific 8 years of abuse that she's had at the hands of her godmother and her godmother's husband. Sal, at this point, is arrested. He gets charged with rape and sexual assault. Despite this, Linda Iglari actually attempts to get custody of Katie. Now, I think we can all imagine that the reason that Linda wants custody is because she's thinking about book deals and getting interviewed by people like Oprah. You can't help but let your mind go there because Linda did not care about Katie at all. But I imagine she cared quite a lot about her bank balance nonetheless. Of course, at this point, they're going to look at the whole situation, both with the mother neglecting her when she was a baby, basically handing her over to these godparents, and also the abuse that Katie's now disclosing about what's happened. And they make a decision, and that decision is to make a much needed intervention in Katie's life. And they place her in foster care. What's very sad is initially for Katie, she felt that the reason that she was being put in foster care was because she'd done something wrong. She felt like she was being punished. And a lot of children who were abused feel this way because they have so little control over the world that they decide that they must be the reason the world doesn't work for them. So by internalizing that, they have a level of control. It's mismanaged and it's wrong and it's terrible for them, but you understand why they'd feel that way. Well, it must be me. So if I can change me, I can stop these things happening to me because it's more difficult to process the fact that you're a victim. And so many children and young people and adults who go through this, they internalize that they are the thing that's broken. If they can just fix themselves, everybody else will start being all right around them. But that feeling is tragic for her. You know, she's been through this horrible experience for so many years, this terrible abduction, this awful molestation, and still she's blaming herself. She thinks, I've done something wrong, I'm being taken away from my birth mother. Because, look, we all know that Marilyn, her birth mother, was a poor example of a parent, but she wasn't abusive in the way that Linda and Sal were. So that had been Katie's safe place to some degree, you know, and she had been having contact with a mum and staying with a mother before the abduction, and she just wants to go home. Marilyn, her mum, did later admit in court that she had been very neglectful of her daughter, but nevertheless, for those several years that Katie was with Sal and Linda, all she did was dream of being with a mum. And after the dramatic rescue, that's where she wanted to go. Now, in hindsight, and I'll tell you a little bit later on in this, she is very glad that she went to a foster home. And her mother was actually ultimately granted limited visitation rights. So it meant that she could still keep the relationship going with her mum, which is obviously very important to Katie and to Katie's mother. Now, the court case plays out like this. The 16th of June 1994, Esposito basically accepted a plea bargain. This plea bargain was done because what the courts wanted to do was to spare Katie the ordeal of a trial. So he pleads guilty to first-degree kidnapping. This form of kidnapping, it's recognised to involve some form of sexual abuse or torture. However, because it's this plea deal and it's not explicit, he was never specifically convicted of rape or actually any form of sexual assault against Katie, which for all of us will be difficult to hear because this man needed condemning for what he'd done, which was rape. Now, the court heard how Esposito was one of twins. He'd apparently had a very overprotected childhood. He'd been a very sickly baby, apparently wasn't expected to survive. Also, he'd had trauma. His eldest brother had actually been hit and killed by a car on his mother's birthday. Now, the judge described this man as having a classic case of arrested development. Not sure I agree with that. I don't think having an overprotective parent and losing a brother traumatically means that you become a child molesting paedophile. Hard to make the link there, but okay, that's what the judge thought. Also, it was noted that he'd lived all his life in the same house, and after his mother had died, he'd basically put his attention and time into constructing Katie's prison. So not only did he apparently suffer from arrested development because of his experiences as a child, it also led to him wanting to build a prison for a child. I mean, I don't think that's got anything to do with an overprotective childhood, has it? It's got something to do with a sadistic predator. So sadistic, in fact, that he's willing to imprison her in a coffin chained up, but I digress. It's also noted that he basically lived all his life in the same house. Again, not sure why that means he would become a predator, but okay, these were brought into the court. And it was noted that pretty much after his mother's death, he started to construct Katie's prison. I don't think that was a distraction plan from the grief. I think that probably the plan to abduct a child was in his head for a very, very long time. And when his mother died, he had the perfect opportunity to do that. Has little to do with overprotective parenting and everything to do with the fact that you are a dangerous, deeply disturbed human being who wants to abduct children and rape them. When he was tried with this plea deal, it levelled at him being sentenced to 15 years at Sing Sing Correctional Facility. Following his incarceration, he applied for parole numerous times. And at a parole hearing in 2007, he actually claimed to be asexual. So go with me on this, guys. He basically said, during the captivity with Katie, being a prisoner of mine, I didn't sexually molest her. I just kissed her. And because of this, I deserve to be released. Skewed logic there. You had a child chained up under your house, soundproof prison, in another prison. I mean, I don't think you saying you're asexual is going to cut it with the parole board. And did it cut it with the parole board? Ironically, yes, they immediately released him. No, they didn't, as ever, nor would they, because they have a brain and a sense of moral decency. So even though he said this, and this was his plea to be released, he said, I'm sorry for what I've done. I'm sorry I even thought it up. It was a mistake. Nope. A mistake is bumping into somebody else's car when you weren't quite paying attention. A mistake is burning toast. A mistake is not planning a prison underground, excavating large amounts of material from home, creating said prison, taking child, placing child in prison. That's a very long, protracted mistake. There's a lot of time to go, well, this is a mistake. Oh, this is a mistake. Oh, this is a mistake. Lot of time to do that, didn't do it at all. Only after 17 days of having that poor child in captivity did he decide it was a mistake when he realised the police weren't going to let up, and the longer he waited, the bigger a problem it would be for him. Now, despite the absence of this rape conviction, we can all agree it was a complete lie. We know that he was raping that poor little girl, and he did get denied parole. And Esposito died in prison in September 2013. The cause of death was coronary artery disease, basically suffered a cardiac arrest. Now, Katie actually stated after this, I'm saddened at the loss of a life, but at the same time, I'm happy that John Esposito will never be granted parole or have the opportunity to hurt anyone ever again. And days before his death, at his last parole hearing, he finally admitted to sexually abusing Katie during the 17 days he kept her in his purpose-built dungeon. Of course, Esposito was not the only person that we know subjected Katie to sexual abuse. Sal did as well. Sal Ingleri was also charged with just two counts, however, of sexual abuse and two counts of endangering the welfare of a child. And because of this, he was also offered a plea deal of a lesser sentence if he agreed to plead guilty. He refused. There he is, in a situation where this poor child has been raped repeatedly, and he is offered a plea deal of a lesser sentence if he just agrees to plead guilty to the charges that they're bringing against him. So the two counts of sexual abuse, the two counts of endangering the welfare of a child, where really there are numerous ones that they can bring forward. But no, he says no. He says, I'm innocent. Kate is lying. And he literally made that little girl go through the ordeal of a trial. And Katie actually states that at the time she'd repressed so much of the abuse that she'd endured because it was too painful for her to even think about it, reflect on it. She couldn't do that. It was too traumatizing. So when she actually testified at his trial about the abuse, she really couldn't disclose the full details. And he was ultimately found guilty and he was sentenced to 12 years in prison, which we all agree is not enough by any stretch of the imagination. But this is the problem. When certain people are put through court hearings, you know, witnesses, people who have been involved in scenarios where they've been the victim, it's very difficult to talk through those situations and reference that awful time. And often this means that some people who the police know are absolutely victims and that the perpetrator is definitely guilty, they don't even get to go through the court case because the court don't feel that they'll be able to manage it. So ultimately, people get away sometimes with horrible crimes because it's so traumatizing that the witness, the person who's been abused, just can't be there to tell the story because the court don't think they'll be fit to. They won't make it through. So Katie manages to get through it, but obviously can't tell the whole story. Now, years later, at a parole hearing, again, Sal blames Katie. Bear in mind, the abuse with Katie, as he's concerned, took place when she was less than 10 years of age, yet he's blaming this kid. So when asked why he had abused her, bear in mind, the parole board are there to see if you have managed to make peace with the reality of what you've done and be honest about it. I need to see that you know what you did was wrong so that ultimately if we release you, you realise that there are consequences to actions and the actions that you carried out were reprehensible and you need to never do it again. I need to see that process so that you're not a threat, right? You don't go to the parole board and say this. And this is in Sal's own words. I was standing in the bathroom. The little girl came in. I was standing there and I'd just come out of the shower. I was standing there nude and she looked at me and she just looked at me and I said to her, what are you looking at? And she said, I'm looking at you. I said, you act like you want to touch it. And she continued to look at me and then she continued to look at me and I says, please leave. And she didn't leave right away. I says, well, since you're not leaving, why don't you touch it? And she did. And I allowed it to happen. I mean, in the realms of absolutely delusional to what a parole board wants to hear, Sal walks in and literally may as well have said, I'm guilty as hell. Anybody who tries to suggest that a child molests an adult is clearly somebody who probably needs to remain incarcerated. Now, sadly, he didn't remain incarcerated, although clearly they won't have believed what he said there. You would never blame a child for the abuse that you've caused. Shows you how dangerous this man was. So he eventually gets released in 2006. Not for very long though, because he breaches his parole conditions in 2007 and he gets arrested and he gets returned to prison and he actually had moved to North Carolina at the time, which is why he got rearrested because he failed to register as a sex offender. And so he gets returned to prison and he actually died of a heart attack in February 2009, aged 55. This was after he refused medical treatment, bizarrely. Don't know how I feel about that. Not bad, gonna be honest, not bad at all. And Katie later stated about Sal's death I was happy when Sal died. I hate to say that, but I've never been able to forgive him. He never showed me any remorse, and he blamed me. And I think we all stand very much by Katie's side on this one. Now, one thing that really bothers me about this case is that Linda, Katie's godmother, actually didn't get any charges brought against her, yet she used to force Katie to watch porn with her as a child while she masturbated. That in itself is a sexual violation. And also, whilst I appreciate that Katie's mother wasn't abusive, as in she wasn't the person giving out the abuse, she abandoned her and neglected her. And I think that both of those should have faced consequences. Linda in particular should have faced consequences. You know, she was abused and neglected by the very people who were supposed to take care of her. However, what I will tell you now about Katie, which is important, is that she describes now her abduction as being the best thing that ever happened to her. Because she says that if it hadn't have been for Esposito's disgusting, despicable, reprehensible actions, she would probably never have escaped that abusive situation that she was stuck in with her godparents. The foster home that she was sent to, well, it would finally provide her with the safe environment that she had been desperate for and in need of and deserving of for so many years. When being abducted and...
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
A prisoner in that tiny concrete bunker underground and subjected to the daily sexual abuse, when that proves to be probably the most important thing, the best thing that has ever happened to you in your life, it's got to give an indication of just how horrific Katie's life had been, that she uses that moment, that being abducted and molested and imprisoned, as being the thing that changed everything for the better. What hell was she living in before that? And Katie later stated of her foster parents, "My parents found me for a reason. My dad called in to Child Protection Services after I was kidnapped and said, 'We want her.' So I have this cool thing of saying, 'My parents chose me.'" Now, her foster parents are Barbara and Ted, and they would prove to be loving and doting parents. She said that they would give her the love that she needed to heal. It proved to be a absolutely monumental shift in Katie's life. She moved into their comfortable home in East Hampton, which was beautiful, and far from being a lonely, neglected child, suddenly she had four siblings and a really stable family. For the first few years, she notes that she was, you know, really angry, unapproachable. And this is completely understandable. She was horribly traumatized. She also felt like she had done something wrong to end up being fostered, remember? So these are very unmanageable feelings. Before she actually started her first day at Springs Elementary School, the teachers held this special assembly and they warned fellow students not to question her about what she'd been through, because they wanted to make her transition to that school a good one and one where she didn't feel that she was just the center of attention. In spite of that, of course, kids are very inquisitive, and you can bet your bottom dollar, if I knew that there was a kid who'd been kidnapped and kept in a prison, I would have been like, "Tell me about it." I wouldn't have been able to do what the teacher said. I'd have been like straight next to her. "We should be friends, but only after you have gone through in detail everything that happened to you. I want to know it all." That's why I talk about true crime. I'm very nosy about these things. That's why you like listening to it. We're very nosy about these things. We care about people's experiences. We want to know the details so we can kind of understand the depths of what people have been through. And likewise, a lot of her peers felt the same. And you know what? She answered all their questions. But very quickly, she just became another regular school kid. As soon as they'd kind of explored that with her, learned about her, she just slotted in. Initially, it was recognised at her foster home that she was treated differently to her siblings. You know, she had a lot of major adjustments to make in a new life. But not long after, she started to get treated exactly the same as the others. And that included the introduction of much needed discipline into her life. And her foster parents made sure that she had good routine. They made her go to school. Once it had been optional, now it was absolutely mandatory. She also had to help with the housework. She had to do chores around the house, but these were just very basic ones just to teach her about responsibility. Whereas in her previous life, as I've talked about, she was basically a slave. And she actually recalled one day where she just felt this sense of absolute amazement. She got herself into trouble, basically, not anything bad. But her mum's response to this was to ground her. And she couldn't believe it because she always got beaten. So that in itself was just shocking that here was this punishment, which was you're grounded. She's like, is that it? Because she'd been through hell. Also, she recounts the fact that it was her mother, her foster mother, who showed her how to brush her teeth properly. She'd never even been taught oral hygiene. Her teeth were yellow and they were rotting. Her foster dad, well, he taught her basic cooking skills. And crucially, one of the things that her foster parents did, which I don't believe Linda would have for a moment, is they just kept the intense media circus that still surrounded her away from her. They protected her from it. They allowed her to just start living a normal childhood for the first time in her life. Later, she enrolled at East Hampton High. She played volleyball. She was team captain. She played tennis. She took part in drama productions. She had a steady boyfriend. Then she went to college in Pennsylvania, and here she met her future husband, Derek, in 2004. And he slowly but surely helped her to build her trust in men. She also completed a degree in business management, and then she started working in insurance sales. Kate is now a mother of two herself, 12-year-old Logan, 10-year-old Hayley. She loves being a mother. She did find it difficult. She talks about that. She found it difficult when her kids were very young because she would look at them and see their beautiful little bodies that she would just protect at a cost to herself any time that was required. But all she could see was herself in those moments, and she thought about the horrific abuse that she suffered when she was their age. She made absolutely sure they had the childhood and the innocence that she was denied. And although she confesses that she found it very difficult to let her kids out of her sight, she was absolutely determined not to be a helicopter mum. So that's like basically a cosseting parent who won't let a child do anything for fear that something bad will happen. And one day she says she plans to tell them her story, and what an unbelievable story it is. She says, I try not to be sad about what happened to me because ultimately it made me who I am today. And I'm very satisfied and happy with my life. My life is exactly what I wanted it to be. Two parents who love me, siblings who are amazing, and a husband and two kids. You won't be surprised to find out that Katie has very little contact with her biological mother and half-brother. However, she maintains a very close relationship with her foster parents and siblings in East Hampton, the family that changed her life. She's since written a book about her abusive childhood, culminating in her abduction. It's called Buried Memories. Oh, it's a tough read, but it provides an insight into the horrific abuse that some children silently suffer. She now, along with all of the amazing things that she's completed, her degree, having two kids, surviving, writing a book. Well, that's not enough, because she now campaigns on behalf of other victims of sexual abuse. She is desperate to remove the stigma that causes many not to report the abuse that they suffer. She believes that it's so wrong that victims carry the shame. And she says, the person who has sustained the abuse should not be ashamed. It should be the abuser. But we need to talk about it more. It's easy for victims to think that there's only one way to go in life, and that's downwards, because they think that people don't care about them. But I want them to see that's not the case at all. I am living proof of that. It's an amazing story to tell you, isn't it? Not least because we're telling it through the eyes of the woman who experienced it. This is her story, told her way, her truth. And ultimately, it's a story of great hope. It's a story of possibility and potential. It's a story of surviving the position of going from victim to survivor. I think we can all agree that Katie is outstanding. The fact that she has devoted her life to helping others, again, warms my heart. Also, it will never be something that I forget, that for that child, that 10-year-old, just 10-year-old child, it was the moment that most of us would fear most, being abducted, raped, tortured, put in a prison, that would be her moment of redemption. How tragic it is that that dark situation would prove to be the beautiful new beginning that she had always deserved.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.